Welcome to our Core Christi monthly discussion. My name is Rachel Pachta, and this month we're kicking off a brand new study on He Leadeth Me, an Extraordinary Testament of Faith by Father Walter Chizik. We also get to meet two amazing holy women and dear friends of mine. The first is Angela Whitehouse, who is joining us as our new co-host for our monthly discussions. She is a wife to her wonderful husband and has three beautiful kids and has served in all kinds of ministry and honestly, so many that I can't list all of them. She is a prayer warrior and a very steady friend, one of my best friends, and I'm so grateful that she's joining these studies. Our guest for He Leadeth Me is Kate Harmeyer. Kate is also married and has two wonderful girls, and she's the director of campus ministry at Christopher Newport University. She has a master's in theological studies from the University of Notre Dame, and what led me to reach out to Kate for this study are her beautiful spiritual insights and her ability to speak life-giving truth. She's someone who I think anyone would want to sit down with to have coffee and discuss a book just like this one. So, without further ado, here is our first episode on He Leadeth Me by Father Walter Chizik. Hi, Angela.
Hey, Rach.
Hey, Kate.
Oh, hello. Happy day.
I'm super excited for us to start He Leadeth Me. This is one of my top five favorite books of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, same. Me too. Same. I love it.
Second reading it catapulted it into the top five.
Yeah. I feel like, Kate, you've talked to people who are like, oh, I've read that book. I read it five times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of those.
Mm-hmm. I think you can too. Like, this is my third time. And every time I read it, I'm like, oh gosh, like I didn't even remember this part, or it's just so good. So good.
Or you kind of remember like, oh, this is coming for me. And the next couple of pages, I remember. And you can't wait to kind of get to it and like, just let it rock your world again.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
I've got a couple of books like this. Read of God, Our First Study is like this for me by Carol Houselander, because she's so, even her style of writing is so rich, and I love that style of writing. And so I don't write that way, but I'm enamored by the way she communicates. And so I think that it's awesome. And then this book, it's a manifesto of prayer, practice of the presence of God. It's like all discipleship and following of Christ in one book. Mm-hmm. And even though I will never live his story as an undercover missionary priest in Soviet Russia during and after the Second World War, he somehow still relates it to me.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's like a good father. He's like, okay, so I learned these life lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't even say this, but let's be real. They're a lot harder than what our life lessons, at least mine are, I know, up to this point have been. But he's like, I've learned these life lessons, and I think that God and his providence saved me so that I could write these down for you, my children.
Yes, very much so. And I just love, like, you can tell that something was written in the spirit when every time you look at it, you gain something that is just speaking to the heart of who you are in another way. The same words are just opening in another way. And I love that he's just like, realizes, it seems like, okay, you will not be an undercover Jesuit in Russia in the Second World War, but you may have encountered something similar to this in this way of your life. So he reaches intentionally to us to bridge the gap between the extreme that he's experienced and maybe the slightly more mundane that we do.
Yeah, for sure.
We just finished in Core Christi, The Context of Holiness, and now we're going into this vastly different story.
Right. So yes, Saint Therese, you know, her whole life can be summarized in probably about three sentences. You know, if you're just looking at her life, she was born and she was little, she entered, you know, the religious life, and then she died at 24. And yet in that, she has all of this beautiful theology and this spirituality that, you know, now she's a doctor of the church. And but it's so vastly different from this man's story. You know, he has this whole history of his life, and I think it's a whole separate book of just what happened to him in Russia. So it's like a lot of story there. Yet he also has this beautiful theology that he brings out of it and spirituality. It's just cool to see different people living different lives, yet both desiring and pursuing the Lord and pursuing holiness in different ways, because it looks different, right? Like, we know that it looks different in everyone's life. So I just love that. I love his life story and what he brings to us. So
yeah, I think that's one of the awesome things of studying the life of the saints. I've been on this life of the saints kick for the last 4 years, probably. And it's this awesome way of seeing how our Father is the Father of all of us. And he wants all of us to attain perfection in him, which is like total surrender and love. And that happens in so many different ways. So we can't put it in a box and say, it has to look exactly like this. You have to be, you know, like St. Francis and actually sell all of your possessions and go wear a habit and live as a celibate the rest of your life. Because then what do you do with St. Zelie? Or what do you do with Servant of God Elizabeth Lisieux, you know? Or there's St. Dominic, who goes around preaching to the world, you know, St. Ignatius of Loyola preaching to the world. But then you have Blessed Charles de Foucault, who was like, I'm not called to that. I'm called to celebrate the Mass in Algeria, where I am the only Christian. I'm the only priest in like thousands of miles. But I'm here to work among the people in peace and love with them, and to celebrate the Mass so that Jesus is present here, so that maybe this presence here, this contemplative presence, is going to prepare the way for a preaching order to come. Mm-hmm. And that was his whole, the whole thing that God had called him to. And the thing is that God's going to call us wherever he calls us. And if we look at comparison, or we, you know, try to formulate like all of these exterior things have to happen for therefore me to become a saint, you know, to become holy, that's not how he operates.
Right.
So,
no, and his knowledge and his heart and his infinity is such that there's a path to holiness for each one of us. Mm-hmm. And and he knows what we need to be sanctified, mm-hmm. you know, in our own personal heroism.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
All right, ladies, let's talk about first chapter, Albertine. The war happens. The Russians are here. Everything shuts down and they're forced into this Israel-like moment. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to hear what you guys thought about that whole segment of his life.
You know, in that first couple of pages in that chapter, Albertine, which I hope is the correct pronunciation of it, there's this moment he describes where everything changes in a moment. And I think we've all had that at some point in our lives, where there's this radical opening of our eyes to reality or evil or just how good we had it. And then all of a sudden everything changes. He says, you know, you just have this realization that tomorrow will never again be like today. When the Red Army comes in and things really start to shut down, he's looking at the same landscape, the same physical space, and just having this deep understanding that, oh my gosh, if I could just turn the clocks back, I had things better or more comfortable or more routine. Oh my goodness, this unsettling, this like shaking of the ground beneath you. Yeah, I think we've all had those moments at a less, you know, maybe intense experience than an invading army, but a diagnosis or a death in the family or just the loss of something that was really foundational for your identity. And all of a sudden you kind of look around and you're like, no one else is seeing the world like I'm seeing it right now.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is terrifying. You know, it's that moment of realizing this is never going to be the same. Just a few pages after that, he goes right into there from this question of why has God allowed this evil to happen? He says, why could God allow this? You know, it's just so interesting because within the first few pages of the book, I think it's on like page three, he's already, you know, asking that question of like, you know, why is this evil taking place? Which is like, you're like hit with it.
Right into it.
Yeah. Right away. Right. Mm-hmm. But then just like as you're going through this, you're pulling out that theme, Rachel, of just that dependence and that trust. You know, he goes in the story of Israel and how they were longing for God. They had had this special covenant with God. And then he goes on and he says that he was trying to teach them again and again that their faith must only be in him alone. He was leading them through every trial and in every age to the realization that God alone is faithful in all tribulations. And I just love that that is the, that's the message that he just brings throughout this entire book, is that faithfulness and that dependence on God, and that he is able to say after all that he has been through, that God alone is faithful. It's amazing. I mean, what a powerful witness.
I'm on page 20. Israel's troubles were in truth a manifestation of Yahweh's special providence, his special love for his chosen people. Like a fond and loving father, he was trying to wean them away from trust in kings or princes or in armies or the powers of this world. You know, Jesus says, in this world, you will have trouble. Almost everybody in the entire world went through the Second World War. What was the response to it? We just talked about this with the context of holiness. Lots of people lose parents. Lots of people struggle with trauma, just like Saint Therese. But what did she do with it? Mm-hmm. What did she do with it? And I think what I'm seeing here from him is he embraced the reality that God was his loving father. Even when I go through little changes, and it's something that I don't love. I'll get, my temperament loves stability and routine. And so when that is shaken up, I feel like I'm floundering for a little bit. And I'm like, but God, like, what if I fall? What if, you know, the wind and waves are coming? What if I fall? Come help me. But that he's always there in his providence as our father. And what we do is just admit there's an other. He is my father and he is taking care of me and he leads me. I'm not walking alone and he happens to help me along the way. He is the one who is leading. I think, you know, we look at these people who became these really amazing, powerful saints that came out of that period of time. It was like they looked at reality through those eyes.
But it was a journey even for him. I mean, he takes it in a couple of pages here from saying, you know, if God must allow natural disasters or wars because of human failings, why can't he at least allow his flock to be shepherded and comforted during such calamities? From that to a few pages later to kind of saying, you know, that perhaps he must allow our whole world to be turned upside down in order to remind us that it is not our final destiny. And that those of us, I like you, love a good routine, love to settle into patterns and procedures of life. I feel very just kind of spun up if I can't put 2 feet on the ground and have some sense of what's coming next. But when our routines become so comfortable, we start to really put our roots in this world and remove our eyes from our ultimate home. And sometimes God allows, like the Israelites, you know, they got out of Egypt, they step into freedom, but then it's a little, the physical comforts are not so much in the freedom. Yeah. And so they're like, well, at least back in Egypt, we had food. At least back in Egypt, we had our flesh pots and our waters or whatever it was that must have been delightful. And so, you know, they long.
Flesh pot.
Yeah, they long for the slavery.
They long for those flesh pots.
Of comfort. The slavery of comfort, you know? And so in God's providence, he allows these things to be a reminder that he alone provides. He alone is present and ever faithful. Because in times of ease and comfort, we're relying on our routine and not him.
Right. There's a growth that happens in kind of when we do receive the grace of that stability of life for a period of time, when we're able to, I guess, exteriorly, our circumstances are circumstances of rest and steadiness. But it's very difficult. I don't know anybody. I can't think of anyone I know who always had that, because it's not healthy for us to just remain there. God leads us through phases and through segments. And yeah. I think too, when you were talking about, you know, this massive thing that has happened and it has changed our life forever, like the image that just comes into my mind is someone who has lost a husband. Like he brings that up, someone who's lost a husband, a wife who's lost a husband, or, you know, parents who've lost a child. Gosh, like a marriage can be disrupted by infidelity. Things like that where this huge thing happens, that can be a moment where God is like, we're in the desert, but this isn't the end. And this is actually, like, this has happened, and now I have something for you next. And I'm leading you to a promise mm-hmm. next. And I think for Father Chizik, you know, it's like, yeah, this got really shaken up. And we know what happens next in his life. But in that moment, he did not know. He didn't know. He had to go through that process. But for Father Chizik, the next thing was going into Russia. And then the next thing after that was being imprisoned and living this life of redemptive suffering. And we now are reaping the gifts. How many people are reaping the gifts even after he has already gone on to the Lord in heaven are still reaping the gifts of his ministry?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Because his life was turned upside down in this moment mm-hmm. that God used it for that. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important as we go through this story to remember that God uses these things, you know, these sufferings and these pains. He uses them to kind of to shake them up. Evil happens in the world, and that's a separate thing. But it's like mm-hmm. evil happens, sickness happens, all of those things are separate. But God can use those to really shake us up, to bring good out of it. I think I do like how he talks about the failing to see all these things from God's perspective. The failing is on our part. He says he is always present and ever faithful. It is we who fail to see him or to look mm. for him in times of ease and comfort.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's, I feel like that's an invitation to us as we're going through suffering, as we're going through pain. It is that invitation that God constantly invites us to say, I am with you and I am faithful. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of make that distinction too, that those things happen and God mm-hmm. uses them
mm-hmm. yeah,
to bring good.
Absolutely.
Right.
That somehow, some way in the just abyss of his redemption, we'll get to heaven. We'll look back at all the terrible or difficult or struggling things that we went through in our lives. And from that perspective, we'll look back and say, we do it again. Mm. That it was for the salvation of our soul, of the souls of others. We just can't see the intricacy of the ways that our journey. And you know, is Father Chizik watching us podcast on it right now? You know, it's just, you know, just to think of how isolated, and I'm sure we'll get to that more in the chapters, like how isolated he felt, how alone mm-hmm. he felt, but how God's grace multiplies his solitude to touch the souls of millions he has never met.
Right.
It's so beautiful.
Oh, all right. I wanted to talk about in the second chapter, his decision coming from this traumatic happening in Albertine, and he's with his people, and then going through the decision process of entering Russia.
Chapter 2, Discernment 101. Ugh, it's just so beautiful. When he talks about the three musketeers, I just feel like that is just so beautiful, like to have that companionship, that these were these three priests who felt called into Russia and the world is falling apart around them and they're just giddy that their dreams and their hopes and their what they felt that the Lord had called them to was finally being realized in a way. So, you know, the Red Army is everywhere and they're just like loving this. I'm seized by this interior joy. I have no doubts, no fears, no hesitations. This must have been what Abraham felt like when he was leaving everything behind, but he knew it was God's will. Like he goes through this period of just joy at seeing what God's doing in his life and like seeing the ways that all of his past maybe is starting to just kind of click into place in his realization. And it's such a beautiful consolation when you kind of are able to look back and to see, oh, yes, I needed that. before I could go here, or he was there along the way. And so he experiences this, of course, right? Like, we'll go to Russia in the spring. Like, let's go. Yeah. And then...
This is such a normal process, right? And then his mind starts kicking in like, but wait, I don't want to leave these people. I really love these people. Yeah. And I'm abandoning them. Am I abandoning them? What's the right choice here? My summary was the decision between two good options. Mm-hmm. God had one thing he wanted in particular, but Father Chizik went through the discernment process between two good options. Where he says, finally, I decided I could not leave Albertine. I could not leave a church where I knew I was wanted. I could not leave a parish whose needs I knew intimately. I could not run from danger or from persecution in order to follow a vague and largely idealistic vision of future service in a distant land to an unknown flock.
Right. I love this whole kind of process of discernment that we're able to see in his life, because we've all been there. You have that joyful, you're like, yes, this is great. Then Rachel, you were talking about, you have then it kicks in like the reason and the, okay, I have to this and I have these concerns and I have this. And then he says, I turned to prayer, but my mind was in such turmoil, my intellect so actively involved in weighing reasons pro and con that I could not hear the voice of God. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how many times have we been there? We're making mm-hmm. a decision, whether it's a job or whether should I do this? Should I, you know, try this new ministry? Should I? And it's just, you're like going through it, and then you go to the Lord and you're like, all right, the Lord's going to tell me. It's going to be so yeah. clear. It's going to be perfect. There's going to be like all of these shiny lights as I walk into the adoration chapel, and we like go to the Lord, and it's like, wait, what? I didn't hear anything. Like, I heard nothing. Like, and so right. I love his transparency in this discernment process where he's saying like, I couldn't hear the voice of the Lord, but then the best part is he takes an action, and that's such a right. huge part of discernment. He decides, he says, I've had this on my heart for a long time. I'm going to Russia. Yeah. And he takes that action. And then, of course, he talks about the fruit.
But what I love is that he actually made a decision before that decision. And his first decision was, I'm going to stay.
Oh, that's right.
I'm going to stay here. And that it's okay that he made that decision, because it wasn't like God just left him to sit in his decision that we know ultimately wasn't the one that it seemed God wanted him to do, right? So, but it was like, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to do this. It was a decision in life of like what he was going to do. And God made it clear to him, actually, that was not what my plan for you is.
Right.
But that's okay, because mm-hmm. at least he was moving in a direction. Yes. And sometimes we have to move in a direction, even if it might not be the right one right then, to then discover, wait, but there's no peace here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's no peace here. So I've made this decision. There's no peace here. And that his father did not leave him. And it's like, oh, okay. So I'm going to now show you and you the lessons you learn from that whole process. And it can be agonizing to go through it. It can be agonizing to watch somebody else go through it. But his will prevails, and right. he doesn't leave us high and dry.
Yes. That is such a truth. That if our ears and our hearts are open and we are using intellect, but yes, and also faith, we're not going to miss God's will in our lives. You know, like if you're truly in prayer and rooted, that God is not going to allow us to kind of miss the boat. If the boat left, it wasn't your boat, right? Like he's going to be there through it. And so I love that he gets so like, he gets pulled down from his like euphoria by his obligations, pulled back down to earth by good, holy things that are a part of who he is called to be. But then discernment he has this beautiful line. The truth of every mysterious action of his grace is discerned in the light of faith rather than by the powers of reason or of intellect.
Yeah.
And how many times do we go to adoration to discern God's will? And we go in there, and like you said, Angela, but we're waiting. We're like, and God, now please speak it unto me, and I will receive it, and I will do it. Instead, all we hear is our own voice and our yeah. pro and con list and our reasons. And but to settle into the fruits of this decision, mm-hmm. and that's where he is able to literally reverse course from what he had intended to do. I mean, what humility, what trust. And I think following his journey and watching the ways that the Lord is just drawing him more into a trust in God's will and not his, this radical detachment from your plan and letting, again, we keep kind of saying it, letting God lead, letting God lead.
Yeah, I love this line. God's will can be discerned by the fruits of the Spirit it brings, that peace of soul and joy of heart are two such signs. And I just love that. I wrote that down. It's the peace of the soul and the joy of heart. And how many times I've experienced that in discerning marriage with my husband. Like, I remember he asked me to marry him. And as soon as I said yes, it was that peace, that joy. You know, it's just that, you know, it's different. This is from the Lord. It's unique from what we've experienced before in just what we feel. Like, there's a deeper understanding when we have these fruit of the Spirit. Yeah, just so beautiful.
I had that too when I was discerning marriage with my husband. And I remember I was just so clear. Like, I was like, oh, this is definitely it. Took him a little longer, I'll be honest. Actually, one time, funny story, he tried to break up with me. And I was like, no, you can't.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. That's not going to work out.
Nope.
You're an error.
I don't know how I even pulled that off of like convincing him like that, no, I think that this is the right thing. You just might need a little longer to realize it. And he did. You know, but on the day we're recording this right now, Michelle Munoz is entering the Servidores, who was on this podcast for the first two book studies. And she was at our house on Monday night. We're recording this on a Saturday, the day she's entering, Feast of St. Teresa of Calcutta. Man, if there's somebody who is steady, steady, even, it is this woman. And not this, like Rachel Pacta. It would be Michelle Munoz. That's what I mean. That woman.
Oh, I was sure you were describing yourself.
No, you guys know me well enough.
This girl.
No, Michelle Munoz. Sister Michelle, as of today. And she had the steadiest, most peaceful assurance for a couple of years straight that she was to enter, that she was to enter this order. And it was the peace of heart that accompanied it and the joy of it that was so clear. That was a clear fruit of the Holy Spirit. There's going to be good options put before you, but it's the peace of the Lord beyond reason. To no person on the outside, you know, would think that her option, she had a good job and super smart and super talented. She is the reason we had a podcast for the first couple of book studies, because she taught herself how to edit and taught us how to use equipment and whatnot. Like, she's so gifted. People could have said, why in the world would you go join a religious order? That doesn't make any sense to the outside world. That's not the practical. She had other options. Mm-hmm. She had plenty of options, and they would have been great. They could have been great in the church. They could have been great in the eyes of the world, but that's not what God was calling her to. God was calling her to enter. That was where the peace was.
Mm-hmm.
And that peace is a peace that it's sometimes the pro and con list of our bees and our active brains. Like, there's sometimes still not resolved one bit, but the peace can still exist. You know, there was a line earlier in the book where he talked about the difference between maybe a crisis of faith and a crisis of understanding. And sometimes it's not a crisis of faith. You know that the Lord is calling you into this. The fruit is there. You know that it is the thing. The understanding has not yet come. But the peace and the, it is a joy that can live amidst trial. It may not be easy. It may not be like confirmed externally immediately, this choice that you're discerning, because they were both good options. But it can live even amidst the trial. And that's how you know it's it's grace. Right. Yeah, that's how you know.
It stays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Discernment of Spirits, we had, it was the final episode, the in reading section that we did for Consoling the Heart of Jesus with Father Brian Capuano. And we talked a lot about God's will stays. So that's one way to know that it's really Him. You know, sometimes the enemy or even our own, you know, fickle nature will like get really excited about a really great idea. But the question is, does it stay? Is it still there after 3 months, 6 months, 12 months? Mm-hmm. And that's the test. As God continues, you know, with the prophets, He was in the gentle breeze. He's the gentle voice that just, it stays. So that's, sounds like what happened with Father Chizik.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like that still prevailed. Even though he made another decision, he ultimately arrived at the right one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then.
And yet.
He gets to Russia and wait a second. This isn't exactly what I thought that being an undercover missionary priest in the Soviet Union was really going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was going.
This is probably one of my favorite chapters.
Well, because so often we are like running into God's will along with God leading mm-hmm. us, and we know we're there, and we're jumping, and we're, you know, sometimes on like a train cattle car going into Russia. With all the joy of ministering to the people. And, oh, they don't want to be ministered to. They're overcome yeah. by fear. They're not seeking me out, these people that I'm willing to die full of the love of Christ for. They don't want, or they do want, of course they want, but they are prevented by their fear from having their spiritual needs ministered to.
Right.
Yep.
He says, full of zeal and enthusiasm only to come smack up against reality. And every time I change a poop diaper 5 times a day, that's what I think.
You're like, motherhood was supposed yeah. to be like all these paintings yeah. and statues right. of Mary holding the child Jesus, right?
And then it's like, oh, so beautiful.
It's so yeah. beautiful.
And then it's hard. And then you realize, this is hard. And you're like, but Lord, you're still calling me to this, even amidst the challenges of it. I do. I love this chapter. I love the reality that he experiences where it's like, this is your will, Lord. I'm so excited. I'm, you know, going in here. And then it's just like, they don't even want me, like that rejection.
Yes.
And they are paralyzed. The other thing, kind of a separate note really quick. I just a tangent quickly on this.
Yeah.
There was a thing that struck me by the people being paralyzed by their fear of experiencing the Lord in the sacraments or not wanting to, you know, come close to Him, or He was willing to witness to them, willing to, you know, give them the sacraments, and they didn't want to. They were paralyzed by their fear. And that really stood out to me of like, how many times are we the people who are paralyzed by our fears? Are mm-hmm. we the people who say, Lord, like, I want you, but I don't really want you because I don't know what that's going to, you know, mean for my life. Or even for those of us who might not have gone to the sacraments in a long time, like, are we paralyzed by our fears of being a mm-hmm. bad person or just not being good enough for the sacrament? Especially I think of, you know, reconciliation, but just that invitation that the priest had a desire for these people. And in the same way, that's the desire the Lord has for us, for His people, to just not be paralyzed by this fear. So kind of a side tangent on but I just really, I was struck by that as yeah. well. He's gung-ho.
They're not. And he's just disappointed. He's disappointed. And like these lines, he says, this whole Russian venture seemed now to have been a mistake, an ill-conceived missionary effort based on hopes and dreams rather than on hard facts, a plan born of insufficient information and misinformation, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to say, it's the same temptation faced by everyone who has followed a call and found the realities of life were nothing like the expectations that they had right. of it. It's just like, just the freedom to just be disappointed sometimes in the ways that
absolutely
where we expect consolation, we just receive something that's different than our expectation. And this was so much that for him.
Yeah. That he goes through a self-knowledge and a knowledge of the will of God. For him, God brought good out of that situation. It was another lesson for him. It says, and then one day, together, it dawned on us. God granted us the grace to see the solution to our dilemma, the answer to our temptation. It was the grace, quite simply, to look at our situation from his viewpoint rather than from ours. It was the grace not to judge our efforts by human standards, but by what we ourselves wanted or expected to happen, but rather according to God's design. It was the grace to understand that our dilemma, our temptation, was of our own making and existed only in our minds. It did not and could not coincide with the real world ordained by God and governed ultimately by his will. It's page 38 in my version. Man.
Yeah, that's so good to find that in the midst of that confusion that he had this beautiful revelation that it's okay, I need to see things as the Lord sees them. Like I need to have, and I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about so often how we perceive our situations, just our daily situations. It's just like if we stopped and we just thought about like, Lord, how are you seeing this right now? Mm-hmm. Like, this is how I'm seeing it. And it's kind of like, I'm worried about it. I'm really stressed out about it. But it's like, how are you seeing this right now, Lord? And that's kind of what I thought about when I read that. It was bringing the Lord into that, like putting on the lens of faith, the lens of wisdom. Just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a beautiful reminder to kind of in the moment that you're in the emotion that you're in the poopy diaper situation that you're in Israel. Whatever it is in Israel, when you're in the desert with no flesh pots, that you would just kind of say, Lord, where are you here? How can I find you here? Where do you want me to do the next good thing, the next right thing, the next thing that's in line with your will? And for me, when I have simple revelations sometimes where everyone already knew this forever and ever, and it doesn't matter how many classes I've taken or how much ministry I've done, I didn't get this at the interior level yet. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, that's what people have been saying forever. And this book, the thing that it just keeps pouring into me is that God's will is happening right now in the present moment. Like God's will is working out our salvation with what we have been given this day, right now. This is it. It's not somewhere in the future that I need to figure it out and put the right puzzle pieces and say the right prayers and receive the right things. And then I can put together his will so that I can discover it in some future moment and live in it. It is the current moment. And he, I think, just gets hit by that truck in a way when he runs into Russia thinking he's running after God's will and he's just going to discover and live in it because it has been revealed that this is what it will be. And then he gets this disappointment and he hears, oh, but wait, this is it right now. I can always act. I can always be acting in accordance with his will, even when I feel useless, even when I feel that my vocation isn't being lived out among these people.
There's a temptation, and I remember feeling it as a young adult, young women who have not found the love of their life, you know, their holy husband, and that's not in their current situation, are no less able to be fully united and living out completely God's will in that moment because that thing doesn't exist yet, and that's in his hands. So right now, it's in this moment, how, Lord, can I be united with you? It's a dangerous thing when we put our vocation over God, over God's will.
Yeah.
We can't make our own vocational discernment as though a God, an idol, as though that were the end goal. It's not.
No.
It's not. I just wish someone had shaken me earlier and said, listen, the goal here is heaven. The goal here is complete union with God. And that happens now in whatever he decides on the path to give to you as a means of, as St. Ignatius says, and he mentions on page 39, to praise, reverence, and serve God our Lord, and by this means save his soul. Then he'll bring it to you. He's not going to hold out. Mm-hmm. But it's today, right now, our vocation to love him. Mm-hmm. He's always first. And I will tell you, if you have that mentality, whatever does come one day, if it comes, whatever happens to come, it will be so much more peaceful. It will be so much more fruitful because you won't have to detach yourself. Even if your vocation comes and Mr. Right walks in the door, you're going to have to detach from it if you want to grow closer to the Lord. Mm-hmm. You have to detach from that person. They're not going to fulfill you. Mm-hmm. I was probably, 5-6 years into marriage until I finally really understood I've been putting my marriage over God. And I thought that I was doing the right thing because this was supposed to be my vocation and people talked about this and like the vocation of marriage, but I was putting it before God.
You're making it the end and not the means.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's dangerous because you're living in a moment of his will at every moment, right? And so if our minds and our hearts are placed in this future moment, we can't commune with him fully in this one because we're thinking about our future selves and not our current selves. We can't be fully loved as we are right now if we feel that we won't be able to love him fully until we're with that person or in that vocation or, right. or whatever. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's so true. So true.
Yes.
And I think maybe a practical thing on that note is if that's something that is struggled with, something I had to do was rearrange my life around putting God at the center and living my life and making choices during the day. This is when my prayer time is. This is when I'm, you know, formal prayer, right? I'm going to start going to daily mass. That was a big thing for me. These are things that I feel like, Lord, you're calling me to show like that you're first. You're first mm-hmm. in my heart. Mm-hmm. Also, conversations. Who am I surrounding myself with? What am I looking at on the internet? What am I reading? Like, mm-hmm. are these things leading me into having anxiety about the future? Mm-hmm. And if they are, Lord, show me how they can be stripped away so that it's only you and I can surrender to being only focused on you.
Like, what voices do you let in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how do they kind of cloud that? Speaking of daily mass, can we look at the section on the mass
yes,
here?
Please.
'Cause I can't, I can't let it go. It's just so beautiful. Yeah. It's 38-ish and it's a long paragraph, but I'll just kind of skim through it, that they would sneak off into the forest and celebrate mass in secret, he and one of his priest friends. No vestments, the stump of a tree as an altar, constantly on guard against discovery. Yet the mass gave them strength. And they took turns preaching little homilies for one another. It just touches my heart. And amazing how impressive the gospel message could be in such circumstances. Our spirits would seem to drink in the words, savor them, and feel the divine power in them. And then here it talks about the consecration and that the sacrifice of Calvary had never been celebrated here before, but it was made totally present. The consolation of that sacrifice, that offering, would stay with me as we returned home through the darkness and silence of the forest. It was so beautifully described. Can't you just see it? Like, you can mm-hmm. just see these two priests sneaking off into the forest in the middle of Russia with all that they're carrying, with all the disappointment or the inability to celebrate mass for the people, and yet still finding such strength and consolation in the simplicity of the mass in the cathedral of the trees. I mean, the reality of the Eucharist, the reality of the power of the gospel, of the Bible, is so glorious.
That Jesus was present in that place. Physically, the grace poured out in that place is worth, even if there was never, you know, I don't want to spoil the story of what's going to happen to him, you know, towards the end of this story. But even if he never actually had a congregation in Russia, period, going into the wilderness in the midst of a country that had rejected God and exalting him and allowing him to become physically present in the midst of his children who had turned away from him or who were seized in fear. The graces of that we don't see, because God doesn't see as we see. That was the point of this, right? What he was just talking about, that I have to see things the way God sees them and not the way that the world judges success.
Yeah. The line here was, sorry, I just love this paragraph. I can't stop doing it. We ask for his blessing on those for whom we labored and prayed in secret, for those who themselves were perhaps praying in secret, but who couldn't worship him publicly.
Mm.
It's just this defiant fatherly love. It's just, you know, just relentlessly I don't know. I just picture this dark forest and the light of the world coming into it.
Mm-hmm.
And being truly present and being effective,
mm-hmm.
despite no one knowing about it, except these two.
Mm-hmm. I know. I love it. You know, it changes the way that we should go to Mass, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we have the opportunity. We go every day or every Sunday. And I don't know just how they were doing. They had to do it so much in secret and how powerful it was. And as we attend the liturgy, like, what a gift, you know, just reminding us of the gift of the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just it's amazing. Mm-hmm. So amazing.
Yeah, that the Lord of them all exalted humility, that he was there unknown to everyone else, but he's their Lord. He's the firstborn of all creation.
Mm-hmm.
And in his humility, in his exaltation of humility, was right there, present among them and with them.
Yes.
Amen.
Yes, truly incredible.
I think, you know, how often do we drive by a Catholic church where Jesus is present within always, and we just think it's just normal, you know? Like, it doesn't really, but he's the Lord of all going on. He's in charge, the one who is in charge of everything, and he's exalted that humility.
Yeah.
It's not in our concept of power, because he doesn't need to prove himself. Mm-hmm. But he's there with us and he's exalting humility to us. But I don't know. I just think it's amazing.
It is amazing. I've gotten into the habit of, when we pass Catholic Church, I've always said the sign of the cross, but I've gotten into the habit of asking my kids to say, "Hi, Jesus." And so we drive by, "Hi, Jesus."
Yes.
And then they just are like, it's just adorable to hear like a little 3-year-old's voice saying that. So
oh, that is
from
beautiful.
The backseat.
Mm. We will start that straight away in our family. I love that.
Yeah.
So he's thrown into prison in human circumstances, you know, totally degrading. So he's stripped of any human comfort that he did have in his tough environment. Father Nestrov at this point is no longer seen. So I don't know. We don't know what happens to him. Maybe he mentions it in the other book. But he's alone. And there are people around him who, when they find out who he is, want absolutely nothing to do with him and they despise him. And he becomes the oddball out. So he doesn't even have the comfort that the others have of camaraderie in the midst of this terrible, inhuman situation.
If there was a time for him to feel sorry for himself, like I'm always like when he brings up the fact that he was indulging in self-pity, I'm like, well, I kind of get why, you know, like, but he was in terrible conditions. He was isolated, like you were saying, Rachel, from any human action. I mean, everything was stripped away from him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And the loneliness and everything that he was experiencing, like, I mean, definitely justifiable why he was feeling self-pity.
Right. He was being treated in an inhuman way, not only physically, but then also socially. He says, "I was being treated unfairly, unjustly, and out of prejudice. There was no one to listen to my sad story and offer me sympathy, so I was feeling sorry for myself. This was really the extent of my humiliation." So he was feeling this way, but the answer I love is a dose of self-knowledge. When he asks for God's consolation, what happens is God kind of first shows him, like, you're feeling really sorry for yourself right now, but that's not what I'm calling you to. I'm not calling you to be liked.
Mm. Yeah. He says here, he was going looking for consolation, and the grace he received in return was the light to recognize how large an admixture of self had crept into the picture. He gets this dose of, your life is for others, go serve. And that is your consolation.
Yeah. He has a really human response. You know, first, it's a human response of like, this really stinks. And I don't like that I'm in this circumstance, because we're not designed to be in that circumstance, you know? Mm-hmm. Like he's being treated unfairly, and people are wronging him. But our Father, he reaches in and shows him, like, you're feeling sorry for yourself. I'm now going to sanctify this experience. let's draw this up into the divine. And I'm going to purify your heart. I'm going to show you you're in self-pity right now. But what I need you to do is to endure this injustice as my son endured the same injustice.
Right.
And only by grace can we do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So even it's like the fruit of his prayer of like, Lord, I need you to comfort me. And he did. But sometimes when we're comforted, the first thing that has to happen is he has to show us what's going on in our heart and that maybe we brought this on ourselves. But not feel bad because it's a really human response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? I think it's very, very easy to, in our day-to-day life, to have that self-pity and to kind of just be like, but no one else is in this situation with me, you know? Like, mm-hmm. honestly, sometimes in motherhood, it can be very isolating. It can be isolating in a lot of, maybe it's in isolation of, you know, you're a single person in a vocation, or isolation in so many different situations. And it's very easy to fall into that self-pity. Mm-hmm. But I love that this invitation that the Lord gives to him, he says that he was asking me to forget about my powerlessness against the system and to look instead to the immediate needs of those around me this mm-hmm. day, in order that I might do everything that it was in my power to do by prayer and example. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what the Lord asks of us, is every single... It's not like we were talking about God's will being, you know, kind of a future thing, when it's like, no, it's now, it's today. So like, mm-hmm. it was just the Lord's invitation to him. Today, I'm asking you, the people that are right in front of your face, mm-hmm. to just be present, to do what I'm asking of you by prayer and example. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It's just that day to day, that mundane, consecrating it to the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And he had said, you know, his experience of the priesthood and of the way that priests were treated was so different than obviously being looked down upon. He was used to kind of being right. respected and in some ways, you know, revered. And it was this humbling experience where he realized that his healing, in a way, his consolation was going to come in this humiliation that would cause him to think less of the circle of kind of self-pity, but to realize that the experience he's having of suffering, of humiliation, is going to make him better able to connect to the feelings of the others around him. Like, he's going to mm-hmm. have grown in the sorrowful part, that he'll be able to serve them better because he's experienced that. And that in Christ, yeah. we see the ways that he entered into the depths of the human condition, you know, betrayal and just the yeah. the sufferings of the body and abandonment and all of those things that we experience. That's what he's doing in a way here, is entering into yes. all of that, that he can be Christ's tool to turning the suffering of others into their salvation as well. He just seems to really get this dose of grace, truth, booster shot to like go forward from this experience of hitting a really low. Ugh, right. Just so good.
It is so good.
Just to wrap up this section on arrest and imprisonment, because it goes so well with the context of holiness and what we just talked about in our last study. He said, "We were not and did not have to be the product of our environment." I'm on page 47. "The conditions were degrading only if we let ourselves become degraded. Under the worst imaginable circumstances, a man remains a man with free will, and God stands ready to assist him with his grace." Beautiful how in the midst of trials and evil treatment, we retain our free will. And grace works in the midst of us operating our free will mm-hmm. to serve God, submitting it to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I loved it.
I love that too. He doesn't expect, there's a line where he says, like, God doesn't expect you to overthrow all evils, but he does expect you to act as he would act in the circumstances ordained by his will and providence. And his grace will not fail to assist you in it. That's beautiful. Yep. Our humanity is not removed by the circumstances in which we are, find ourselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. You guys ready to move to our last segment?
Yeah.
On Lubyanka.
The School of Prayer.
Lubyanka.
Yes, exactly.
The School of Prayer. He's in this very terrible, long silence, absence from humanity, other humans. And I think it also really highlighted the fact that we are made as communal beings. We're made for community, and we actually can't even really function in a sane way without being in community and being in the presence of someone. And we talk about when he was forced to share a cell with somebody, it was like, oh, I just want to talk to you. Even though you might go report on me, I just want to talk to you. You know, I just need your presence. And of course, like you said, the school of prayer.
Oh my God.
And how in that silence, man, the things that he unpacks about prayer are so powerful and so helpful too.
Mm-hmm. How he just struggles with the silence because his mind has so much room to work. And how, you know, not having someone that you can unpack the mind to, it really starts to cycle into his prayer life and his difficulties with quieting the mind. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. It was just like he opened up my skull and dove right in describing that the mind, which is our chief instrument of human communication, can be our chief stumbling block to prayer. Mm-hmm. And he manages somehow to use his Jesuit training to establish a routine in isolation that allows him to just dissect the heart of prayer.
Yeah. I particularly loved how he articulates what intimacy and prayer looks like in half of a paragraph. I'm just going to read it because I'd love to hear what you guys think about it. Page 60. There is no formula that works of itself, no magic charm that must automatically be heard by God and produce its effect. True prayer is a communication, and it occurs only when two people, two minds, are truly present to each other in some way. So in prayer, we must do more than merely visualize God as present as some sort of father figure. His fictionalized presence will not do. His imaginative presence will not do. By faith, we know that God is present everywhere and is always present to us if we but turn to him. So it is we who must put ourselves in God's presence, who must turn to him in faith, who must leap beyond an image to the belief, indeed, the realization that we are in the presence of a loving Father who stands ready to listen to our childish stories and to answer to our childlike trust. It made me think of St. Teresa of Calcutta when she wrote this letter to her donors, I guess. It's something along the lines where she was like, I'm really concerned that you don't actually know Jesus. Like, you're Catholic, but you might not actually know Jesus. And I'm begging you to open your heart to him in a dependence and a trust and let him communicate himself to you. Come into a real relationship because he is an other. He is a person. I love that because it's not these formulas and meditation on certain things. I know a lot of times I'm tempted to just stop there and think like, well, I prayed my Divine Mercy Chaplet and my rosary today. I'm good. Even I went to daily mass today. I'm good. Like, it's not. It's not. That's not what prayer is. Prayer is coming into union with the other.
Mm-hmm. And the routines can help. And it's not like those things aren't an aid, but without this, they are just a crutch almost in a way. You know, they're just something that we say to ourselves, oh, well, I've done enough. When all he truly wants, that last part, he wants to listen to our childlike stories and to answer our childlike trust. That we put on a show, much like the Pharisees sometimes, we put on a show instead of actually just opening ourselves to the communication itself, to the reception, you know? I just, it's like he just drops it all right there.
I like seeing too how his prayer changed so significantly when he stopped. He said, I learned to purify my prayer and remove from it the elements of self-seeking. Just the idea of like how often when we come to the Lord in prayer, not that we mean to be self-seeking, but that sometimes it is kind of like, okay, I prayed this, or I sat and I gave the Lord, you know, my 20 minutes today. But when we just allow the Lord to do the driving in the prayer, where we're asking, Lord, I want to be with you. I really just want to sit with you and to put on our hearts, who am I supposed to be thinking of today, Lord? Or kind of surrendering that time of prayer to say, like, Lord, what do you want this time to look like? Instead of me kind of putting in my own agenda. So I liked how he just said, you know, how much he stopped asking for more bread for myself and instead to offer up my sufferings, the pains of a hunger that I felt for the many others in the world and in Russia at that time who were enduring similar agony and even greater suffering. And what a true example for us as holiness, saying, I'm just going to offer this to you, Lord. Just a little bit of, you know, pain or whatever I'm going through, this daily struggle, I'm going to give this to you. And just beautiful, like how he takes it and transforms it and truly changes it.
Mm-hmm. There's a humility in his prayer.
Yes, for sure.
Because instead, that journey from, like you were saying, Angela, going from the self-seeking prayer, which we all kind of start with. I think everybody has to go through that. Self-seeking, like, I want this result.
Right.
This result would be good. Their conversion would be really good right now.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. More food would be really good right now. But if that's not what your will is, then I'm going to turn everything over because you are taking care of me. And whatever is happening to me right now is like what I'm going to give back to you. That, like, moving from I need this for myself to my desire is to worship you. And that's a work of grace. I think he had such an openness in all of these stories that he's sharing with us and the lessons he learned. I think the thing is he was such a humble soul and he was willing to be changed and he was willing to be formed and willing to be corrected and willing to be brought into something better in his interior life. Mm-hmm. In exterior, but a lot of this is just so interior, like what God's bringing him through due to his exterior circumstances.
Right.
I love that way he articulated what it's like to be humble, even though he didn't say that, but that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to share it. I mean, to have the humility to not just go through this for your own sake, to record it for us all to learn from and to identify ourselves in.
Right.
One of the things that really just, it spoke to my life, it was the morning offering that he began his day with, the morning offering. It's a prayer that has really changed my life in the sense that you consecrate your day to the Lord. And sometimes, as we were kind of discussing a little bit ago, I'll go through half of it without having truly prayed it. I've said the words, but I haven't truly prayed it. And then I'll make myself kind of go back like, no. Like, let's actually say these words from say them from your heart, mean them, that you're offering whatever this day brings to him through the Immaculate Heart of Mary. You know, to think of prayer is this relationship, this communion with the true presence of God who is always present to us. Our turning, our presence to him is the true act of prayer. And there are these beautiful prayers of the church that saints have prayed in every age across the world. And he was praying that same prayer that we can unite through time, through space, through wherever in that. It's just so beautiful. It's such a uniting factor that the church gives us. Mm-hmm. It's so powerful. And he goes even to the Our Father, just how he grew in such appreciation for the perfection of the Our Father that Christ gave us in his own words and instructed us to pray. The part that I love so much, sorry, I'm just like on a tear right now, is when it's like he gives himself and God gives him the grace to be merciful with himself and his distracted mind. Because I need that so much. You know, that he says that God initiated this conversation by inspiring us to set aside time for prayer, and he appreciates our efforts to respond and he blesses them. That even in all that silence, he was not able to silence the human mind from distraction. He was free of every distraction from the outside world, yet the human mind will still wander and work. But the Lord understands and blesses even that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like our child who's trying to talk to us, you know? Mm-hmm. And it might not be totally coherent. He's even more the loving Father who's so happy for us to be there. And yeah, we have tools, and he'll give us tools to be able to pray, to remove whatever distraction, or to, you know, learn methods of prayer, like Ignatian prayer. It's helpful for you, but that it's all just a gift so that your heart can draw closer to his heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I loved page 59 at the bottom. If we could constantly live in the realization that we are sons of a heavenly Father, then we are always in his sight and play, that we are always in his sight and play in his creation, then all our thoughts and our every action would be a prayer. That, mm-hmm. What a release.
Yeah.
So now we are always in his sight. We're sons and daughters of the Heavenly Father, and we're playing in his creation. I loved that. Just totally changes the way the world is seen. And it helps us embrace the reality of what the world is. It's his creation. And we're playing within it. And all of this is union with him. All of this is being who we are, which is his creation.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it.
God made this creation for us to delight in. And that brings him delight. When you take your kid, you get excited to take them somewhere really exciting and you really hope that they like it and it should have everything that they need to be able to enjoy it. And then they do, because they didn't bicker with their sibling on the way there and they didn't, you know, forget their water or whatever. And they just do. Yeah. And you just have those moments of seeing the delight in the experience, the eyes, the physicality of your child. And as a parent, to just to revel in that, it's just a taste of what the Lord feels as he watches us work out our lives in his creation. Mm-hmm. I love at the end, this really simple summary. I had to learn to turn to God as best I could and when I could. And he goes in a long description, you know, weak from hunger, weary and pained after interrogations, distracted by doubts, all those things. I had to learn to turn to God as best I could and when I could.
Amen.
All right, guys, this was a gift to get to have this time in this discussion with you. And I am really excited for the rest of this book because it's so good. All right, ladies, so until next time.
Goodbye.
Thanks.
Bye.